Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly CashLack Memorial Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Our topic is endometriosis. We had two great guests, Dr. Isabel Green and Dr. Adela Cope, and we'll tell you more about them in just a second. But first, Paul, can you please tell people what is it that we do on the Curbsiders, and can you introduce our wonderful co-host?
Sure. Happy to do both, Matt. As a reminder, we are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And as you alluded to, we are joined by another co-host, the amazing Dr. Carolyn Chan, or addiction medicine specialist extraordinaire, a primary care expert, all around excellent human being. Dr. Chan, how are you?
I'm great. So happy to be here. Haven't done one of the main show episodes in a while.
Why is that, Carolyn? And do you have any any of your own podcast episodes available, or any seasons of a new podcast coming out anytime soon?
I'm so glad you asked. We are deep into production of season 3 of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine Podcast. So we will be releasing brand new episodes starting in July. So be sure to listen to them.
And they should check out seasons 1 and 2. This is its own feed, Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Fantastic content there. So you can turn yourself into an addiction medicine doctor. Maybe sit for the addiction medicine boards. Do it. Paul's going to do it, right, Paul?
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, it's a plug, just the practice pathway is ending soon, so get it in while you have the chance.
Okay. All right. So, Carolyn, will you tell us about our two wonderful guests?
Our guests were incredible today. We have the amazing Dr. Adela Cope, who is a fellowship-trained minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She specializes in medical and surgical management of complex, benign gynecologic conditions, including endometriosis, adenomyosis, and uterine fibroids. She's an advocate for reproductive rights and patient-centered care. And she is here with Dr. Isabel Green, who is also a fellowship-trained surgeon in minimally invasive gynecologic surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, where she serves as the physician lead of the Chronic Pelvic Pain Clinic. She partners with pain psychologists, physical medicine, and PT, and advanced endometriosis surgeons, radiology, and other fields like GI, in an effort to provide patients with holistic and individualized care. And I think, you know, by the time you get to the endo this episode,
I like that.
You'll be disappointed because you'll learn so much.
All right. A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And if you haven't done so yet, you got to sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, you know, hang out with Paul on the Discord server, and a lot of other cool stuff like access to our CashLack vault with all our show notes and figures that we've ever made, 400 plus episodes, patreon.com/curbsiders. Isabel and Adela, thank you so much for joining us, and really excited to talk to you about this topic. But first, we're going to get just to know you a little bit. Isabel, so you first, can you tell us a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine?
Sure. I felt like I needed to resurrect hobbies. So a couple of years ago, I started to play tennis. I didn't play that growing up at all. And I have to say, it's like really healthy to be really bad at something, you know, when you're trying to be really almost perfect every day at work. So that's been a lot of fun to learn tennis as an adult.
How many tennis balls have you lost in this endeavor?
Oh my gosh. I mean, how many tennis balls have I hit in the wrong place? Many, but I have, you know, I always go get them. There's that other perfectionist, right? I still go get them no matter where they go.
I think we should all just congratulate you that you're doing tennis and not pickleball, because that's what most people seem to have picked up in the past couple years.
For sure. for sure. Now we're competing with pickleball players for court time.
Yeah, they paint their lines all over your court, right?
Mm-hmm, they do. They bring the tape. They tape it out, and then they have to pull up the tape at the end. I was like, what is all this tape? Yeah, that's what it is.
I find that feud to be very funny as someone who doesn't play either sport right now. So, Adela, can you tell us your hobby or interest outside of medicine?
Yeah, you know, we're getting into that time of year where we're getting ready for spring and summer. And for me, that means getting seeds started. I love gardening. I love plants. I have a ton of indoor plants too. But most recently, I've been getting some tomatoes and peppers started and getting geared up for outside stuff as soon as the weather gets better.
It's a running theme that the best adjusted guests on the show seem to all be into gardening. And I will say, I have successfully in the past 2 weeks killed off a Boston fern, which I'm very proud of. And then I also managed to massacre a pygmy date palm, which was not inexpensive, but I think is not coming back from the winter. So I don't have whatever skill set is required for this.
I bought 2 basil plants from the grocery store thinking, hey, basil's kind of expensive. If I buy the plant, I'll kill 2 birds with 1 stone. And then one day I will keep one of these plants alive, but I have not. They've all kind of died as my recipe has no longer needed basil. I've just completely forgotten about these plants.
Yeah, I'm really hoping to capitalize on all of her industrious seeding and planting.
Oh gosh, yeah,
we got she's overcompensating.
Yeah, I mean, we got very, very excited with starting stuff, and so I'm going to need to find homes. My garden is good size, but it's not big enough to accommodate all of my little friends that I've made in the last couple of weeks.
Gardens really can put out a lot of like produce. Everyone I know that has a garden that is actually working is like just giving it away. They're like, I need someone to take this. So that's great. It's a shame we don't live closer because I'm a big fan of vegetables, as Paul knows.
Oh yeah. I would definitely hook you up if you were closer.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think, Paul, this is a topic we don't understand. So we're probably going to need extra time on this. Do you think we should get to a case now?
Let's do it.
We have Miss A today, who is a 26-year-old female who is currently not seeking pregnancy and doesn't have any significant medical history. She reports she's been having an increasing amount of pelvic pain over the past few years, and at first the pain was only associated with her menses and was often throbbing. She just kind of attributed it to her normal menstrual cramps, but lately this pain has increased in intensity, and it also occurs without menses. She also describes symptoms such as increased urinary urgency, dyspareunia, and just feeling tired in general. So I'm just going to kick it off to you first, Isabel. What is endometriosis? And can you tell us a little bit about how common it is?
Yeah. So I think one of the challenges is when we think about defining endo, which we'll probably just call it that for the remainder, is that it's still a bit of a black box in terms of our understanding of the mechanisms of disease. So the definition I'm going to give you is going to feel really oversimplified. So we define endo as the presence of endometrium, or endometrium-like tissue is probably more accurate, outside of the uterus. So it could be endometrium-like tissue that you can see on the surface of the pelvic organs or lining the peritoneal cavity. But then it can also be tissue that acts like a cancer and actually invades the serosa of the bowel, or even tissue that exists outside the pelvis, so like the diaphragm or the thoracic cavity. So endometriosis lesions really vary. They can be superficial or they could be nodular, and they can be associated with fibrosis and scarring. So that's the definition based on sort of the limitations in our understanding of even the mechanism of it as a disease. Super common, unfortunately. It affects 1 in 10 reproductive women or people born with a uterus or ovaries. And so to put that into perspective, that prevalence is really close to the prevalence of type 2 diabetes, which is about 11%. And we think that the true prevalence of endo is probably higher, because we're going to talk about this, but one of the primary methods of diagnosis is actually a surgical intervention. So we're probably missing many patients that go undiagnosed. So that prevalence is probably even higher than 1 in 10.
Paul, how's that make you feel about your diagnostic precision here, or how often are you making this diagnosis, Paul?
Yeah, no, it makes me, I'll answer your first question. It makes me feel real bad. we were talking off air. I think I struggle even to know when to think about this. I read this particular case, and I feel like this is a patient who could just be diagnosed with dysmenorrhea like primary dysmenorrhea, given NSAIDs. And then even if that doesn't help with symptoms, we'll be like, well, it's that's still what it is. And then there may not be much more diagnostic workup above and beyond that. So I have the fact that it's probably much more prevalent than we recognize is not surprising to me at all. Since we're on this topic, if you could talk me about what presentations should prompt me to think about endometriosis, that would be a very helpful place to start, I think.
Yeah, I think this patient's story is a really common one. So the fact that things started with menses and begin to extend outside of menses is a really common story that we'll hear. And when we think about those diagnostic delays, you may see this patient at different parts of her story, right? We may have seen her, or we may have seen them when they were 14. We may have seen the patient when they were 18, 22. So it kind of depends on where you're seeing them in their lifetime with endometriosis. One of the reasons that you may be missing endo as a possible diagnosis is because the symptoms can be really varied and kind of be different between people. So we think about the most common symptom being dysmenorrhea, but then there's also pain with intercourse and just generalized pelvic pain, so pain even outside of menses. And then more complicated is that some of these symptoms can also span across organ systems. So they might actually present with more bowel-related symptoms like painful bowel movements or bloating. They may present with painful urination, and endometriosis is probably not on a lot of people's differential for painful urination or voiding dysfunction. And then a common symptom can be a generalized symptom like fatigue. So this patient really sort of represents almost a classic patient with symptoms that extend sort of across organ systems, sort of started with dysmenorrhea and then have it extended, you know, into sort of non-menses. And, you know, we're going to talk about a lot of myths to dispel. And I think one of the big myths is that if the pain is outside of a period, you know, outside of that cycle, that it can't be endometriosis. And we definitely know now that that's not true. You know, whether it's the inflammatory process, whether it's the fibrosis, whether it's the adhesions, whether it's the fact that the nodules themselves of endometriosis sort of create microenvironments that sort of run independently of a menstrual cycle and the ups and downs of hormones. The fact that someone has pain outside of a period should not lead you away from endo, you know? So that idea that you said, that sort of classic, you know, I thought it was dysmenorrhea, I started them on NSAIDs, I gave them the pill, you know, but now they're coming back with pain outside of their period. It definitely can't be related to that. It must be something else. And we definitely want to kind of dispel that myth that, you know, it actually can still be endo and probably is more severe endo.
If it's this common as 1 in 10 women, or maybe even more than that, do we think to some extent it can be like a normal to have some endometrial implants, but not all people are just like having any symptoms? Can it be one of those type things?
Yeah, thanks for saying that, Matt. One of the symptoms of endo can be no symptoms. So people can be asymptomatic, and we might find the endometriosis totally incidentally, either on imaging or on another surgery. You know, they go in for their lap chole and find pretty significant endometriosis. So really right now, poorly understood disease, not only in how it sort of evolves and manifests and its pathophysiology, but then, you know, why some patients will have significant pain symptoms and others won't.
And is there a correlation between number of lesions and the symptomatology at all? Like, is that straightforward, that the more is worse, or is it truly that varied in protean?
Yeah, you see Adela shaking her head. Unfortunately, it's not, which is, again, why sort of there have to be other sort of mechanisms that are driving the symptoms. We may see someone with really superficial endometriosis. That's what I was mentioning, where it's like kind of like almost like salt and pepper shakes on the peritoneal cavity and the peritoneal lining. And they may have severe disease in the sense of their symptoms. So really mild disease burden is what we kind of call it. And then really significant symptoms and the opposite too, lots of fibrosis, but not a lot of pain. So we, you know, the world of endometriosis research is making some progress, and we're kind of looking at phenotypes of endometriosis finally, the same way you would with other diseases. And kind of trying to categorize them in terms of ways to study etiologies, mechanisms of disease, responsiveness to therapy, sort of based on these different phenotypes, because there is no kind of all the same endo. And that kind of limited our research before, because everyone was put together into kind of one package for research.
This episode is brought to you by locumstory.com. You know, audience, there's a shortage of physicians out there, and locum tenens physicians, well, they help alleviate that strain. And did you know that 72% of healthcare facilities are now seeking locum tenens physicians? That's almost double what it was a decade ago. And I know maybe you've been thinking about this, or maybe you've been thinking about a change in your job. Well, now is the time, because there's a lot to learn about the industry, and that's where Locum Story comes in. They're your source for all things locum tenens. And you can find interviews on the Locum Story podcast with experts sharing advice about everything from finances to physician burnout, as well as firsthand stories of providers who work temporary locum tenens assignments, and they can tell you the ins and outs of all that. They'll even get into why they worked locums, the experiences they've had, the advice they want to give others looking to try it. You have questions, they have answers, and you can find them by tuning in to the Locum Story Podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. That's the Locum Story Podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. This episode is brought to you by Freed, an audience. You know, I'm a huge fan of Freed because Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. How many hours of your life have been stolen by the electronic health record, sitting there in your couch, in your pajamas, typing notes on your off hours? Get your life back. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Arez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed as a solution that can help you alleviate that daily burden that you have as an overworked clinician. So Freed is there to help you. Freed is already loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It's HIPAA compliant. It takes 30 seconds to learn. It costs only $99 a month. And let me tell you, your time is worth a lot more than $99 a month. So check it out. What have you got to lose? You can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of the Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. That's freed.ai. And use the code CURB50 for $50 off your first month.
Could you give us some of just the broad buckets of the phenotypes?
Yeah, so we think about superficial endometriosis, so kind of stage one or two. You might hear about stages one through four of endometriosis. And even within that phenotype, there's probably going to be a category of patients that on top of the endometriosis probably have a significant sort of abnormal inflammatory response. And they may or may not also be manifesting with other sort of systemic symptoms. So, you know, things like chronic migraine, POTS. This is where, like, you know, the questionable overlap with like mast cell disorders, things like that starts to come into play, in that there may be something both neurologically and in terms of like an inflammatory environment that's driving the symptoms. It's not quite the lesions themselves. And then the other big phenotype would be the ones that act more like a cancer. So lots of fibrosis, lots of scarring, and an invasive nature, you know, develop blood cells, recruit nerve fibers, you know, really kind of act sort of in that pro, you know, growth stage that you see with cancers and how it damages surrounding tissue. So those are just kind of the two big buckets.
I did want to go back to the pathogenesis so we don't sort of move past that. How much do we know about where this comes from or how this starts? I feel like I was taught about retrograde menstruation somewhere, medical school, maybe, like when I was prepping for this episode, that kind of rang a bell. But where do we think this comes from, and sort of how does this all begin, do we think?
Million-dollar question. So definitely something that's being studied, and not retrograde menstruation. So that would not explain, right, thoracic endo, right, diaphragm endometriosis in patients that are not menstruating, you know, or that don't have a uterus but have ovaries. So definitely not that. The question is sort of that idea of whether it has to do with changes in a cell. So sort of like a misdirected cell line developing into endometriosis. Lots of sort of questions right now of, you know, where it comes from. What's hopeful is that as the basic scientists start looking more and more into those processes, we might be able to learn more for better therapeutics, since we're really limited right now in the therapeutics that we have, based on the idea of that definition being that it's just the endometrium. So you'll hear a lot of us say it's not quite just the endometrium, but we can't quite define it yet.
There's a lot of work looking at the immune system as well and microbiome factors. There's a lot of different angles that people are looking at this disease process, but I think as far as how all of those different factors interact together and how that translates into the multiple different phenotypes that Isabel talked about, we don't really understand that, unfortunately, at this point in time, but there's a lot of great questions out there that people are looking into.
And whether things are like the driver of the disease or coexist with the disease, so still a lot to tease out there.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned that depending on when you see a woman in their course, it may be a different picture. Can you talk about like what you think of as the course of endometriosis over the lifespan?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily a progressive disease in some patients in the sense that it may not worsen over time. But one of the, you know, one of the challenges with patients is that while we classically, you know, would see them, you know, at the time of menarche with painful periods, and that might be a time where we'll think of endo. We may be most likely to think of endo at that time because it's sort of a new, you know, a new event. The challenges, I think, with the lack of awareness among providers, and I'm so glad we're here doing this podcast because this is a great step. But then also like the stigma and normalization of pain with menses, is that in sort of that 7 to 10 years that it takes the average patient to be diagnosed with endo, you have a couple things that might be happening because endo patients are at higher risk for both central sensitization and chronic overlapping pain condition. So I kind of think about it as they can almost like acquire more disability, broader symptomatology, and more pain severity than they might have had earlier. So they may present with pelvic pain and, you know, TMJ and chronic low back pain. Those are classic overlapping pain conditions, or irritable bowel syndrome and interstitis. So patients' disease may present differently because they're seeking fertility now, or they've gone on hormone replacement and things have changed, or they were on the birth control pill for 17 years and then came off of it, you know, so a lot of people go on the pill early. So there may be differences in sort of how the disease is showing up. But then on top of that, they present differently because a lot of them have had sort of this opportunity to acquire more illness and sort of more impact over time. So it kind of makes it harder to like find the trees in the forest, right? That endo is one of the main trees in their symptomatology, and sort of attack that one along with the other ones. Does that make sense? So sort of like it can get overwhelming when someone with chronic pelvic pain comes into your practice and they've never had a diagnosis of endo. And it's important to still think of endo in that patient the same way we want you to think of endo in a patient with primary dysmenorrhea or painful periods. But yeah, we do see interesting things. Like I was doing great and then I stopped the pill to try to get pregnant. And now, you know, I'm experiencing all these symptoms of painful periods. Or I always thought my periods were, you know, painful but manageable, but now I have pain with intercourse, you know? So it might be that something's changed in their own sort of environment, whether that's hormonal or due to, you know, other medical conditions that we're not sure of, or just due to the chronicity of it and the acquiring of other pain conditions and central sensitization. So not every patient may look the same.
And I'm wondering if you could just really briefly run through what would your differential be for this patient? Because as you said, there's so many things that could be possibly going on, but just kind of give us a summary of what we should be thinking about and considering.
Yeah. I mean, obviously endo, that's why we're here. So endometriosis is on there. You know, you mentioned, Paul, you know, primary dysmenorrhea, and that's a legitimate disorder as well. So painful menses that's not secondary to endo, that's probably due to the inflammatory nature of menses and, you know, the uterus and the cytokines and the prostaglandins and all of that. So that's definitely on our list, too. We'll treat patients initially not knowing if it's primary, you know, dysmenorrhea or endometriosis. But then, you know, I mentioned just now, like, overlapping pain conditions exist. And so it's pretty crazy. So a patient with endometriosis is at higher risk for developing other pain disorders. So they have like 5 times the risk of developing IBS, so irritable bowel syndrome. So this patient could have endo as a cause of all their symptoms, right? If it's involving the bladder, if it's involving the peritoneum over the bladder, if it's involving the bowel, right? Because she had a lot of different symptoms. Or she or they could have endo plus, you know, IBS, or endo plus painful bladder syndrome. Or I think one of the most important ones is endo plus myofascial pain. So hopefully we can spend a little bit of time talking about that, but that's tender or pelvic or taut pelvic floor muscles that can contribute to some daily pain, some voiding dysfunction, some defecatory dysfunction. So this particular patient, you know, kind of started in one category, right? Painful periods. And now it's not always during her period. And it's kind of recruiting other organ systems. Yes, that could be endo, but that could also be myofascial pain. And we definitely want to think about that because we're going to treat that totally differently, right? We're not going to treat that hormonally or surgically. We're going to treat that with physical therapy. And we'll get a lot of referrals for surgery for like oophorectomy when someone really just has, you know, a tender trigger point in their pelvic floor and really needs PT. So we can avoid a lot of surgery by almost tunnel visioning to endo and blaming everything on endo. So I'm going to ask you to do 2 things, right? Sometimes always think endo. And sometimes think of other things besides endo. So this is a great example of a patient that it could be either.
And Paul and I just did a show recently on recurrent UTI with urogynecologist, and she was mentioning that you know, that the myofascial pain, and when she's doing the exam, just feeling for tender points, and sometimes that's what it is. And pelvic, she said her pelvic physical therapist that she refers to as like her favorite person because she's able to help a lot of her patients with that referral.
Yeah, that's a huge partner for us is our physical therapist for our endo patients and our pain patients that don't ultimately have endometriosis.
And I think all of us in primary care, like we do get these patients that have these clusters of symptoms where they have IBS and they have painful bladder syndrome and maybe fibromyalgia, migraine headaches, and chronic fatigue symptoms that they'll complain of. And now endometriosis wasn't something I was thinking about, but now I'm going to have to kind of reexamine some of these cases and think about, because I know we're going to talk about imaging, or maybe now is a time to talk about a little bit more about the actual diagnosis, because, you know, what do you do to try to sort that out, I guess would be where we're going. Are we ready for that question now, Carolyn? Or we have anything else? Paul always accused me of jumping the gun. That's why I'm asking.
We're ready.
Well, because you do.
I know I do.
I think it's good because I'm asking you to try to separate these things, but we haven't talked about how you can try to separate
them. Tell us, please.
Yeah. So Adela, how do we do that?
You know, it's very, very challenging. There's a lot of overlap, and we do not have great non-invasive diagnostic testing for endometriosis, unfortunately, for a lot of our patients who have this disease. You know, we talked about imaging, labs, physical exam findings. Those are all great things to make sure you're not missing anything else. But there are some limitations with those. I would say in terms of having a diagnosis of endometriosis, a lot of the time it's going to be a suspected diagnosis, saying they have features of the disease, things that sound suspicious for endometriosis, the symptoms they have. And so that's oftentimes what we're working with to start. It is something where, obviously, as Isabel mentioned, you want to make sure to think about all of these other things that can coexist and do an assessment for each of those. Exam is very important for those, and any other labs that you might be thinking about to assess for other etiologies contributing to pain that could be acute causes or other structures or other organ systems. When it comes to labs for endometriosis, there have been biomarkers that have been looked at, but unfortunately, we don't have any good ones that are out on the market where we would be able to use them for clinical practice at this point in time. Hopefully someday we'll have something, but aren't quite there yet. With imaging, you know, it really depends on what imaging is done. It depends on the protocols that are done, when the imaging is performed. It depends on who's reading the imaging. And all of those factors can impact the sensitivity and specificity for identifying disease and are very important to weigh when you're trying to determine how much weight can I put on this imaging study when the clinical suspicion is there that the disease could be present. And I think first and foremost, it's important to be aware too that even if all of your workup comes back negative, all of the imaging is negative, that does not tell you for sure that you do not have endometriosis, because it can be difficult even to diagnose at the time of a laparoscopy, depending on the eyes that are doing the procedure and looking for lesions. And all of that can impact timing to diagnosis as well for patients.
And you mentioned the suspected diagnosis, because it was interesting, like reading review articles from 2020, they were saying like surgery is sort of the standard for diagnosis. And then the more recent ones, even like a year or two later, were saying now it's becoming more like a suspected diagnosis. You can kind of start treating based on that, because not everyone's going to benefit from surgery. So you want to avoid that if you can.
Exactly. And I think there's nothing that says you have to confirm presence of disease to start treatment. It's perfectly reasonable and important to provide medical intervention for these patients, even without a confirmatory test like a laparoscopy or obvious findings on imaging.
Is there anything, this is like a vague and perhaps dumb question, but that's kind of my role here. But is like a well score for like high likelihood versus low likelihood that people are working on based on like clinical risk factors and symptomatology?
You know, depending on the society that you look at, they have different flow charts to have all of these different presenting symptoms that patients can have. In general, if they have dysmenorrhea, dyspareunia, dyschezia, those are kind of the three Ds you want to think about, there's a very high likelihood they could have endometriosis. I think that in terms of exact scores, there aren't any that I'm aware of. Are there any that you're aware of, Isabel?
No, I think the way I think about it is it's easier to sort of assume at the very beginning if they have those symptoms. And then I would say that your imaging at the onset of your treatment is trying to rule out sort of disease that may need an earlier surgical consult. So if I thought of myself as an internist, I'd say, you know, what do I need to at least get treatment started? And I'd say the history is sufficient. The imaging is going to help me make sure that they don't have an endometrioma, that the ovaries aren't like stuck behind the uterus in an abnormal position. And then like Adela was saying, depending on your access to things, you know, does my ultrasound tech do a sliding sign to see if the rectum is scarred to the back of the uterus? So it's almost like the absence of positive findings can keep that patient in your clinic and not maybe get that early referral for a surgical consult. But the absence of findings does not rule out endometriosis, if that makes sense. So we're trying to look for almost obvious disease with imaging at the initial onset of your evaluation and sort of, you're looking at your symptoms. And in younger patients, that could be just an abdominal ultrasound. So it doesn't necessarily need to be transvaginal, since we're sort of trying to rule out really bulky disease, that the best treatment would be to start with medical management. Does that help in terms of the imaging? I feel like we use it in a funny way. You know, we use it to rule out the really bad stuff, but oftentimes you'll see this normal pelvic ultrasound and that's almost, you know, more anxiety provoking to patients, because they're like, I feel this, you know, and it's good to really validate that that doesn't mean that there isn't disease or that their uterus doesn't have this crazy cytokine reaction to their period. You know, it's very real. We're just not seeing sort of dramatic disease with the tests that we have. And Adela can talk about stuff too, but we use imaging at our level for surgical planning to really look for much smaller findings.
So it sounds like the routine primary care doc shouldn't be ordering an MRI.
I would say not necessarily. I think it depends. I think that, MRI definitely can have a role. And I think a lot of it depends too on what access you have. So it can be very confusing to look at the literature, because depending on where the studies were done, the countries the studies were done, the different protocols that were used to help identify endometriosis that has a huge impact on ability to detect disease. And I think that it's great to start with a screening pelvic ultrasound to start for these patients. As Isabel said, you know, it doesn't even necessarily need to be a transvaginal ultrasound, though that can be helpful if the patient is able to tolerate that and of a, you know, right age group where that's amenable for them to have that done. But it is something where if you see signs that there could be more severe disease present, so say that they have endometriomas, they have a fixed uterus, the sliding sign is not showing good slide between the rectum and the uterus. We have kissing ovaries where the ovaries are being pulled behind the uterus. All of those could be markers for more severe disease. And in the absence of a more specialized, prepped, focused, hands-on ultrasound with a trained sonographer or radiologist, ultrasound's not going to be sensitive to pick that up. And I think that pelvic MRI can be very helpful for those patients, or if you're suspecting disease outside of the pelvis, because that can be very important to help guide, do I need to refer to a surgeon when the ultrasound might not be sufficient to detect those subtypes of disease that are less common, but certainly do exist and do, you know, require additional looks with other imaging modalities.
You mentioned like the adhesions, the standard transvaginal ultrasound, I don't usually see that reported on. So is that more the advanced, like you have to have a technician that's trained in looking for endometriosis to call those things?
Not necessarily. I think that those are little maneuvers that you can train sonographers to add to the screening ultrasound that can add additional benefit to assessment. The more kind of specialized focused ultrasounds that are used in endometriosis centers, they typically involve a bowel prep and are really focused in different areas with a specialized trained person. And so that's kind of the difference between those two. These can be incorporated in screening scans that can be very helpful when you don't have that specialized equipment or training, and are easy interventions that you can add to a basic screening pelvic ultrasound that can add additional sensitivity to look for markers of endometriosis.
MRI can also be helpful, I think, when you've had that normal ultrasound and they're not responding to treatment and you maybe want to look a little bit deeper, but that still sort of requires a specialized protocol so that they'll report on, you know, 2 millimeters of disease, 5 millimeters of disease, things like that. But that's another area where we might expand our diagnostics to MRI from ultrasound. And I wanted to also say that one of the big challenges is that people may move from doctor to doctor, and like doctors will sort of start over. So that can be really frustrating to patients. So trying to build on what they've already had done and not kind of be like, right, I'm supposed to do this first and this first, you know, and be like, oh, wait, this has already been done. Let's maybe move on to the next step. And that's hard in our world. But, you know, the EMR is helping us kind of see what people have had before. And that's one of the benefits. So we're not reordering all the same things, starting the same treatments, giving the same time to see if things work. So that can be really frustrating if people have moved from physician to physician. As you know, that happens, you know, in all of our disease conditions, so not just unique to endo.
Paul, this seems like these patients have to have 5 CAT scans from 5 different doctors before someone thinks to order a pelvic MRI because they're not even thinking about endometriosis. Don't you feel like that's got to be the case?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I feel like this just sounds endlessly frustrating, potentially. And that's the end of that sentence.
Yeah. So Adela, I don't know if that's what you all see as a pitfall, but cause like, I think most primary care doctors would just be like, okay, this person has chronic abdominal or pelvic pain. CAT scan is my image. You know, maybe they'll get a pelvic ultrasound and they won't see anything. And then they're going to jump to a CAT scan because that's sort of mostly what we deal in. We're dealing in MRIs more for like the spine or the brain. So I just imagine that that's happening.
It is. And we'll get referrals where they will have had a CT scan that shows maybe something in the pelvis. Is it a uterine mass? Is it an adnexal mass? And then no pelvic ultrasound, which better delineates all of those structures. Really, there are a lot of limitations with CT in terms of assessing for endometriosis and just the pelvic organs in general. Really, in our field, we think of that more as a tool for when you're trying to assess staging for malignancy, rather than actually looking closely at the uterus and the ovaries and the surrounding structures from a GYN lens.
Well, it's almost a little bit of the hall pass, not to be, but you know, the fact that if you get a CT scan and it comes back reasonably normal, you can be like, well, at least it's nothing that's going to kill you. Like, and I think it's kind of easy to sort of stop there, even though that does not mean you're not debilitated. And, you know, there's not certainly sequelae from this not being managed well.
And I think that's where the awareness of how prevalent this is, right? So think about the fact that it's like as prevalent as type 2 diabetes. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And that it's debilitating. And I think that patients move on to other doctors if, you know, so you don't also potentially get the benefit of questioning your last move, right? Like, the reality of medicine is sometimes it takes us some time, right, to think about what we want to do next. So that can be sort of an added layer of challenge here.
This episode is brought to you by Babbel. You know what, audience? The best way to learn a language, well, it's probably immersion, but maybe that's not in the cards for you, like it's not in the cards for me. So why don't you try the next best thing, and that's learning a language with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and that's why it works. I'm going to Italy this summer, and I'm using Babbel to help me learn how to order a gelato or a coffee or whatever other cool stuff I might feel like doing when I'm in Italy. I even want my kids to use it because I want them to learn some language too. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold, plus all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. So here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/curb. That's 60% off at babbel.com/curb, spelled BABBEL.com/curb. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So just thinking about this patient's case, you know, we did the pelvic ultrasound, absolutely stone cold normal. We've completed our other workup to say, hey, we don't think it's anything else, but endo is still on our differential diagnosis, right? And this person's non-pregnancy seeking. What should an internist do right now? Should we think about referring to you guys to consider laparoscopy? Should we just try to start treating her with something in her office? What should we do next?
I think it's very reasonable to start with treatment in your office before referral. I think that with endometriosis, when that's on the differential, a lot of the first-line treatments are geared towards hormonal suppression in some manner. And that's typically going to be things like estrogen and progestin-containing contraceptives. That can be pills, that can be patches, that can be vaginal rings, depending on what the patient would like to use. If patients aren't a candidate for estrogen-containing methods of hormonal suppression, or if they've been sensitive to them in the past, say they were on an OCP and it exacerbated their migraines or something like that. They were on it for birth control, but now they don't want to go on estrogens for that reason. You can certainly try progestin-only options as well. That can be pills, that can be implants, that can be the IUD that contains progestins. And then, of course, injections too are another option. I would say that really shared decision-making is important when you're trying to select a first-line option, because you want to make sure that it's something that the patient feels comfortable using, that it's something they're going to be reliable to use, and you want to meet them where they are. So you mentioned assessing for desire for pregnancy in the immediate future. That's very important because a lot of the hormonal medications that we use are going to interfere with that, you know, and impact their ability to become pregnant. So if it's a pregnancy right now type of a situation, we're going to be a bit more limited with what we're able to offer as far as medical management. It's going to be more supportive cares. And if they're having pain, we may have a lower threshold to think about a laparoscopy in those patients if they're having pain and we're limited with what hormonal medications we can use. But I think there's nothing wrong with going over these options, offering them, and trying to meet the patient where they are first, and starting these things before you refer them.
So the other things, just analgesics like over the counter, NSAIDs, acetaminophen, those type of medications. I didn't really come across much else besides the hormonal therapies you just mentioned, and then those.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, making sure there isn't anything else going on. Do they need to see a pelvic floor physical therapist? I think is one of the most common things that we see that's very important to assess for, that's also non-hormonal, that also can be very helpful in the setting of endometriosis too.
Are any of your patients having any success with like complementary or alternative therapies? I saw there was actually a ton of clinical trials going on in this space with a lot of stuff that maybe internists would be comfortable prescribing and just other things that are out there. So anything that you've seen promising so far?
I know that anecdotally, I've had patients describe going on anti-inflammatory diets, and that's been very helpful for them. We, in our own practice, have a nutritionist that we've kind of paired with as offering a complementary pathway for kind of more holistic care for these patients. I've had patients that have discussed things like acupuncture. I've had patients that have discussed things like, you know, more like dry needling and things like that, that might be helpful. I think that, you know, we have a lot of limited data in those spaces, but I think that there's definitely an interest in that for our patients, particularly those that are sensitive to hormonal medications or would like to avoid them. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to offer, just knowing that the data is limited.
It sounds similar to what our approach would be for other chronic painful conditions that we're used to treating as well.
A follow-up question about thinking about the OCP. So as you mentioned earlier, one of the goals is hormonal suppression. When we have a lot of folks who are using an estrogen progestin combination pill, there's usually that week of placebo. Should we be telling patients to take it? Should they throw it out the window? What should we be telling them to do with that?
The way I approach that is I try to talk about it with the patient, because for some of my patients, they feel apprehensive about fully suppressing menses. And so they feel that that might be like a healthy thing for them to have, or that might be that just that sense of reassurance that they're having a menses or not pregnant, and they'd be more fixated on not having one. And so I try to tailor it to what they're feeling. If it's someone who would still like to have a menstrual period, we certainly can start that way and see how they do, because it still may be beneficial from a pain standpoint just to use the OCP in its typical fashion in a cyclic manner. One of the first things I would do if that's not effective is see if they're open to trying it continuously. And so skipping that placebo week and resuming a new pill pack right away after those 3 weeks of active pills. If someone is open to trying full suppression, so to speak, trying to fully stop periods from happening or menses from happening, then I typically will start them on a continuous, again, with stopping at that placebo week and restarting with a new pill pack. You can also do the vaginal ring and patches in a continuous way as well. There is some large claims database studies looking at, you know, risk of VTE or thrombosis in these patients using these different things. Not specific to endometriosis, but in contraceptive use. And there is some suggestion that the patch might have a higher risk of that. Now, we don't know how that was being administered. We don't know how reliably it was being used. It's all large claims database, you know, studies, and so don't have granular data. So that might be the only thing that would make some people pause. But I think that it is still reasonable to talk about as an option if that's going to work best for them. One of the things with continuous dosing is there is higher risk of breakthrough bleeding. And so navigating that can also be difficult for patients. And so talking about setting up expectations when you're starting these things, abnormal bleeding can happen with any of the hormonal medications we start, even when you're doing it in a cyclic manner. And so trying to get through the first couple of months at least to get through that and see how things will go is important as well. And then if you need to, every several months, have a withdrawal bleed to help with breakthrough bleeding, that's also very reasonable to do to try to navigate that, because that is something that can happen with continuous dosing.
That's really helpful. And I'm also curious, is there any evidence that like progestin only, you know, contraception would be superior, inferior to a combination product for folks with endo?
Yeah, you know, we don't have a lot of great comparative data across all of these modalities. I would say in general, the progestin only options, it depends on the type that you're using. For example, the lower dose norethindrone mini pills, so to speak, they might not be as effective for suppression. They certainly are an option and they're approved for contraception, but the more kind of potent norethindrone acetate, that's a higher dose. That would be typically what we would think of as a progestin-only medication to use, but it's not technically approved as a contraceptive, even though it probably impedes with pregnancy. And so we get into these gray spaces with some of the progestin-only medications. There are progestin-only contraceptives that are newer, but cost can be a barrier for those. And so as far as are they superior, I don't know that we can say that for sure, but it is something to be mindful of when someone is, say, not a candidate for estrogen-containing contraceptives from the get-go, or say they've tried combined methods in the past and it hasn't been effective, it's worth thinking about trying a progestin-only option for them just because they might respond to it better.
I think knowing that there's a higher dose progesterone pill is really key. I don't know how clear that is, I think, outside of the world of gynecology. So we'll see a lot of patients on the mini pill, which is like 0.35 of norethindrone versus 5 milligrams. So that's the big jump in dosing. And then you can even titrate up to, you know, 5, 7.5, 10 to get amenorrhea or no bleeding. So I think knowing that there's a progesterone alternative that isn't depo, that doesn't involve a procedure like placing an IUD, is a really nice sort of bit of knowledge to take away, because it's not probably commonly used, I would guess, in primary care.
Yeah, I guess it depends on where people practice, whether or not they're managing, you know, birth control on a regular basis, because in where I practice, gynecology is doing a lot of that management. So it's sort of, it's not something that I'm used to. So those doses and things, I'm always having to look up anytime I'm doing that. I'm going to do a little bit of a recap because we've talked about so much and we're going to get on to the second part of the case. So we talked about just way back, the definition is presence of endometrium-like tissue outside the uterus. That's the definition of endometriosis, or endo, as we've been calling it. And there's many different types. It can be superficial or nodular. It can cause fibrosis and scarring. We said the two main buckets, if we were trying to phenotype, it would be more of like the superficial. And sometimes, I believe you said, they could get some systemic symptoms with that, or it could be more of the fibrosis and scarring and invasive type that almost is behaving more like a malignancy. We talked about some of the most common symptoms. There's lots of symptoms. It could be dysmenorrhea, it could be pain with intercourse. We said it could be pain with having bowel movements. Yeah, dysuria, bloating, fatigue could be there, all these things. So kind of vague symptoms that we see. And we talked about there's a lot of overlap with other conditions. So our differential might include primary dysmenorrhea, IBS, painful bladder syndrome, or even just myofascial pain, which we could diagnose on a pelvic exam. And then the diagnosis used to be just by laparoscopy, but now we can sort of operate on this is a suspected diagnosis based on the clinical features. And, you know, we would still try to rule out some other causes, but there's not a biomarker we can go by. And it's sort of the clinical history. Imaging in primary care might be a transvaginal ultrasound we could order. We probably won't see much on a CAT scan, but a pelvic MRI might be something that you all would order if we refer to you, or maybe we would order that depending on the availability of specialists locally and how severe things are and what if we think someone might need a surgery. And then first line treatment, you said largely it's hormonal, estrogen and progesterone containing contraceptives, or we just got done talking about progestins. And then pelvic physical therapy might go along with that, NSAIDs and acetaminophen as well to help manage symptoms. And we talked about a little bit of complementary alternative therapies, but nothing that is 100% for everyone, sort of anecdotal stuff. Some patients, that seems to help them. Any big things I'm missing or anything that I misspoke about? Because it's always helpful for me and the audience to remember if we got anything wrong in our recaps.
I think just that the normal ultrasound doesn't mean it's not endo. And then if you do see something on ultrasound, that's a good time to get a referral to a gynecologic surgeon sort of earlier on than you might have. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Carolyn, let's go on to the next part of the case and we'll delve a little bit more into the management of this.
Yeah. So we actually start our patient on an estrogen and progestin containing OCP. They return to work in 3 months and report that while their pain has improved, it still is interfering with their ability to work. So my question for you, Isabella, is how do we actually monitor hormonal therapy for effectiveness?
That's great. I think Adela kind of laid the groundwork for my answer to this question, which is how important it is to have sort of patient-centered goals here. So some patients might have such severe pain with bleeding that any degree of bleeding, even light bleeding or spotting, is, you know, leads to severe symptoms. So that person's goal would be amenorrhea or no bleeding at all. A different patient, you know, the effectiveness may be still having a regular cycle, but hoping that there's an improvement in their pain. And we don't really focus on sort of like a pain score or did I get you from a 5 to a 3 during your cycles, but more like thinking about functional goals for your patients. So this patient, what's concerning me is even though they've seen improvement, you know, it's still interfering with their ability to work. So you might see a dampening of period-related pain, but if we're not seeing the functional improvements that we're hoping for, you know, people, it may be an ability to exercise. It may be an ability to socialize after work so they can like make it through work, but they can't do anything else, you know? So patients will really have an idea of what they think improvement looks like. And so I think in this patient, the fact that there's still a significant interference with an ability to work tells you that you're not quite where you want to be therapeutically. And I would look further or kind of reassess at this point. And I think like, I want to dispel that myth here too. So 20 years ago in med school, I learned that if you give someone hormones and maybe if you use it continuously and they don't have a period, but they still have pain, that it can't be endometriosis, right? You pat yourself on the back and say, I've successfully suppressed them and they still have pain. Okay, it can't be that. And I refer them to GI or urology, you know, or back to their primary care doctor. So this was, you know, my practice. We're all learning and, you know, we're trying to make progress. So that's something I learned as an OBGYN, you know, 20 years ago. But now we know a few more things that help us dispel that myth. We're sort of peeling back the onion on endo. But we know that endo lesions express aromatase, so they can make their own estrogen. So I can suppress ovarian function. I can suppress the ovarian production of estrogen, but they can defy that and kind of produce, you know, their own. So sort of progressive symptoms or continued symptoms despite hormone suppression, again, you should still think endo. We always, you know, my plug is think endo and then think other pain generators, right? So the flip side is when a patient's not improving, I'm like, did I miss something? Like, did I do that pelvic floor exam? You know, did I really screen better for IBS? Because we also know that if we don't kind of hit all of the pain generators, we don't see the same kind of rigor or vigorous improvement that we would expect with our treatment. So we're like, huh, like why wasn't this a slam dunk? You know, did I miss something? Or is this endo that's just kind of gone rogue and isn't gonna respond to the menstrual suppression?
There's so much to digest, like so many pearls. I think at this point in my practice, I would definitely be referring to experts such as yourselves. And you already stated some indications for which we should think about referring. So you said early on, when we do that original pelvic ultrasound, if there is a finding, we should probably refer to you guys early. I think now, you know, I'm pretty comfortable using OCPs, but beyond that, I don't think I have much experience using medication. So this would be probably the point where I'd really start to refer. What are other times and we should refer to you guys?
Yeah, and I think you're not alone in feeling that way. And I think that that would be very appropriate. You know, if you've tried one hormonal management strategy or even two, and you're like, gosh, I'm not getting the type of benefit I would expect. I have evaluated for other causes of the pain and we don't have anything else to target. It's very reasonable to refer because at that point, we ourselves would be thinking, is there a role for laparoscopy or some more invasive diagnostic testing to confirm this for the patient? And then also to think about, you know, are we going to give them additional benefit by treating the disease if it's there? And so I think that that's very reasonable. The other question, you know, too, is if there's any fertility goals, if it's not so much pain, but say it was more of a fertility question, if they're struggling with infertility, I'd have a lower threshold if you're suspecting endometriosis as well to refer them for more specialized assessment, just because they may be at higher likelihood of needing assistance in some manner to achieve a pregnancy.
And I think Adela gave some good kind of tricks like, oh, I don't like the word tricks because that makes it sound like we're, you know, not intentional in what we're doing, but expansion. So like starting with the pill cyclically, and then you're not getting quite the response that you were hoping for, switch to it continuously and see if that generates more. And then I think depending on, like Matt was saying, how much you're using hormones in your practice, you may be comfortable using the pill and adding the IUD or using the pill and adding, you know, a norethindrone on top of it. But I think that once we're getting to multiple different versions of hormones, that's another sort of patient concern is they'll say I was tried on 4, 5, 7, 13 different contraceptive pills. You know, it's okay to say that what you're doing isn't working and, you know, to try to get a second set of eyes to see if there's something more than what you can offer in that practice. And so it also depends on your practice and how much you do in terms of reproductive health.
Can you, so I think a question that with any referral that I'm often asked, like, well, I think you should see this specialist. The question, the follow-up is always like, well, what are they going to do for me? Which I think is a valid question. I probably should know the answer to it, at least broadly. So I guess, could you maybe talk us through what your first visit with the patient looks like? Let's say we feel pretty confident in the diagnosis, the PCP's done their due diligence, they start the right medications, everything kind of lines up. When you're meeting for this patient for the first time, can you talk us through what that conversation looks like in terms of what their diagnostic and therapeutic options might be above and beyond the things we've talked about so far? So we tried different, say, you know, oral contraceptive combinations and just didn't feel like we were making any headway. What does that conversation look like when you're seeing the patient for the first time in terms of where they're going from here?
I think first and foremost, one of the most important things with that initial visit is giving the patient space to talk and express themselves, because this can be a long journey for a lot of them. And I think that giving them the space to feel the feelings, to express themselves and how their journey has been dealing with pain is very important. It's important for developing a therapeutic relationship. It's very important for them to feel like they're being heard and that it's not wasted time on their part, that they're actually getting to express what their journey has been. Because I think oftentimes, definitely not intentionally, a lot of the time they can feel like their pain has been minimized, if that's a perceived feeling that they have, or they feel like they've been told that it's just supposed to be normal because it's just their period, or they've felt that they've been told it must be in their head because it's pain and there's nothing that we see. And whether that's things that have been said or things that they perceive, I think that giving them the space to express those things is very, very important. As far as other things that we do, I think that we do pelvic exams all the time. That's part of what we do. And so getting another specialized look to assess for other pain generators, I think, is something that we are able to do with our skill set, and to assess what's normal, what's atypical, what are different things that we would be wanting to target that might not be as invasive or might not be driven by hormonal medications. Pain specialists might have a little bit more comfort with targeting some of the other pain syndromes like central sensitization and starting neuroleptic pain medications depending on someone's practice patterns. The other thing that we may have access to would be more specialized imaging to assess for endometriosis in our practice that might be limited in a community setting or in a rural setting or even in a city where you just don't have access to the protocols that we use. And so we might be able to give more information with less invasive options that could help give them answers, which sometimes in and of itself can be very helpful for them. The other thing that I think is important is if you have tried multiple things, we would be talking about at that point, is a laparoscopy warranted? And I think that that's something that we would be able to make shared decision-making with the patient, get a sense for what their goals are. What have we tried so far? What are the limitations potentially of surgery? What are the possible outcomes? And going through all of that in a very detailed way. And those are typically the things that we try to do when we encounter these patients coming from primary care or from their initial referring providers.
And I know too that both of you have been trained in minimally invasive gynecological surgery. So I'm just curious, should we be ideally just referring these folks to like OB-GYN, like our sort of bread and butter, or should we be thinking about specialists such as yourselves? Can you help us understand and differentiate sort of like how to use both of your guys' skill sets?
Yeah. I'll let you go
so
first,
hard.
Isabel. I think
sure.
It's very difficult because access is a problem. I think
yeah.
That there's definitely a bottleneck with specialized care. In terms of endometriosis experts.
Yeah, we kind of talk about like, you know, maternal deserts in terms of OB care. And there's definitely pretty significant gaps in access to sort of more advanced pelvic surgeons. I'm assuming, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but that you have people that you generally refer to probably in your group, in your practice, in your community, and just making sure that the patient will get something more than they could have gotten with you. So a pelvic floor exam, if that's not something that you're comfortable with, you know, potentially placing an IUD, if that's not something you're comfortable with, and then getting a sense as people come back or their reports come back, you know, are they talking about any of those things that Adela mentioned, or do they seem to have access to any additional imaging, or does their assessment seem to mirror, you know, a basic assessment and they may not be getting very much? And that's where I think sort of the referring physician can kind of play advocate, you know, for the patient. And if that OB wasn't the right one, you know, if that OBGYN wasn't the right one to kind of generate a next step, you know, trying to find people in your community that can do so. So I think ideally, if someone is thinking about, if you're at the point where you're thinking about surgery, I think ideally you'd want to be at an endometriosis center, because the reality is that a lot of us out of residency are not trained to do excision of endometriosis or endometriosis surgery. So then we're falling back to what Matt was saying, which is we end up just with a diagnostic scope. And that's kind of what we don't want anymore. We sort of, if you're going to have the surgery, if you're going to incur risk of surgery, cost of surgery, make that surgery count, you know, get a pathologic diagnosis, get the excision of the endometriosis, and be well prepared for that surgery. You know, don't go in and then find, you know, complete scarring of the rectum and you're sort of in a situation that isn't one that you're capable of handling because you weren't trained. So we're really lucky in that we've had this extra training. So you kind of have to walk that line of the gaps and the access to care. And I would say find people in your community that can offer more than you can, right? The idea is for them to keep getting a little bit more, you know, getting better, getting something to help them. So whether that's finding other sources of pain, like the myofascial pain, adding a treatment that you're not able to do in your practice, or really hopefully finding people that can offer additional imaging and surgical excision would be great. So there's probably like that medium referral and then the advanced referral, sort of depending on where you're at. And patients kind of take it upon themselves to find the advanced practices, but unfortunately not after having probably multiple surgeries that were suboptimal.
Agreed. And I think, you know, if you're suspecting advanced disease based on your imaging that you have so far, if you see endometriomas, that is something where even if you don't see deep endometriosis on the screening ultrasound that you're getting, it is something that increases risk of there being presence of deep disease or more advanced disease at the time of surgery. And so it is something where if you're suspecting that, it is ideal to get them to someone who would be prepared to address that. A lot of the time that might mean a multidisciplinary approach to surgery. And so someone who already has the skill set to tackle things and the appropriate collaborations to fully address disease with other surgical specialties, if needed, I think is very important.
Adela, can I just ask, because I think we've said the word once or twice now and haven't defined it. Can you define endometrioma? And then can you just talk about what does it sound like when you talk to a patient about surgery, and does it differ if it's superficial versus an endometrioma or deep? Can you just kind of talk about like broadly what that would sound like?
Of course, happy to. So as Isabel mentioned, there's a variety of different phenotypes of endometriosis, and kind of one of the more common categorizations is kind of superficial, where it's more on the surface, on the peritoneum, tiny millimeter-sized spots. They can be widespread, they can be few. There's endometriomas, which is when the endometriosis actually makes a cyst containing old blood products inside of it. And most commonly, we would see that in the ovaries, though it can be in other spaces as well, but most commonly the ovaries. Deep endometriosis is when it actually starts to put roots into things. So oftentimes there'll be a nodule of varying sizes, and then it passes beneath the surface of the peritoneum. There's different definitions for what that exactly means, but in general, if it's put roots past the peritoneum, then that's when we would typically categorize it as deep endometriosis. And so the conversation in terms of what surgery looks like, surgical risk, recovery, all of that is kind of framed by what the patient's goals are, what we're planning on doing with surgery, and then also, you know, what type of disease we're anticipating based on our workup that we have so far. So if, say, it's someone who's younger, we have negative imaging, we're really just trying to help improve symptoms and also get a diagnosis. We talk about doing a diagnostic laparoscopy with possible excision of endometriosis, looking for those lesions, doing a really close, thorough exam of the pelvis. And if we see something that could remotely be endometriosis in our practice, and what most MIG surgeons are trained to do is to treat or excise it. And ideally excise it so you can get that pathologic diagnosis and make sure that you're not missing things underneath the tip of the iceberg. Because sometimes what can happen when we're at surgery is when you're looking, it can look like, oh, this is a tiny superficial lesion, I'll just buzz that. And there could be a whole little depth of roots that have been put in by this lesion that you'd miss if you're just treating the surface. And so our goal is to try to excise to get all of that disease out so we're not missing any of it, and also to give the benefit of actually getting a diagnosis from a pathologist. With the recovery for something like that, if everything goes as planned, there aren't any major structures involved, typically we're thinking about 2 weeks in terms of recovery. So that's lifting restrictions, typically pelvic rest for that time period, and then also time off of work or school is roughly what we're looking at. When we get into more advanced endometriosis, so say that there is an endometrioma involving the ovary, most of the time, unless we're concerned about it or if the patient is postmenopausal or of a certain age group, most of the time we're talking about doing a cystectomy, which is where we excise the cyst, leaving the normal ovarian stroma behind. When we do that, that does incur some injury to the ovary. And so in terms of weighing that with fertility goals, that is something that we oftentimes would work with a fertility specialist to decide, is this beneficial? Are they going to be doing advanced reproductive assistance? Is that timing important, you know? The other thing that we talk about with patients is if we do see deep endometriosis involving other structures, we oftentimes have to collaborate with other surgeons that specialize in those spaces. Some GYN surgeons may feel comfortable doing bowel resections, but I feel a lot of the time we are collaborating either with a colon and rectal surgeon or sometimes a GYN oncologist in order to fully address the disease safely with someone who does more bowel work than a, you know, even most MIG surgeons would probably do. And so what that can look like depends on the extent of disease. I would say for kind of our bread and butter, if you will, stage four endometriosis involving the bowel, we are thinking about maybe 1 to 3 nights in the hospital for most of those patients. There are some practices that might have outpatient availability, but in general, we want to see some signs of forward bowel function. The recovery with those patients is typically more like 4 to 6 weeks is what the bowel surgeons most commonly recommend, at least in our group. So it does extend it out a little bit. And the risks of surgery are higher with more advanced disease, because even if there isn't deep endometriosis involving these structures, the fibrosis that Isabel described before can be involving the entire pelvis. And that increases risk of injury to things significantly, things like the bowel, like the ureters, like the tubes and ovaries, like the bladder. All of those things can be injured at the time of surgery in general, but particularly when they're all matted and stuck together. And so it depends on the extent of disease we're anticipating, what all we discuss, but that's kind of both ends of the spectrum is what we would typically anticipate discussing with the patient.
Well, we're definitely coming towards the end of our time. We're going to have to let you two go at some point. So Carolyn, if you have like a couple more questions, or Paul, if you have any other pressing questions, we should get to them now, and then we'll go to take home points soon.
I think my one question is, after the surgery, do patients still need hormonal suppression? Is this something that they should be on for forever?
That's a great question. And I would say what we do know about hormonal suppression after surgery is it reduces risk of recurrence of endometriomas, and it can lengthen the improvement of symptom benefit after surgery. So it reduces risk of recurrence of symptoms. And so ideally, if patients are able to tolerate hormonal suppression, we would resume it after surgery for those reasons. It's something where a lot of our treatment strategies are designed to bridge to when we get to menopause, because for most patients, not all, but most, with menopause, our symptoms will get better because there's less hormonal stimulation from the ovaries. There is a subset of patients where that doesn't fix things, but for most people, that's what we're kind of gearing it towards. And of course, want to weigh in there, are they a candidate for hormonal medications? Do they tolerate it okay? What are their fertility goals? Because again, hormonal medications will impede that. And so trying to balance all of those things along that life course is what we try to do as best as we can.
And I think I would say, you know, they might get a great endo surgery and then start the, you know, the medications afterwards again, but still sort of like remembering their original Venn diagram and making sure that we're still sort of addressing all the other sources of pain. If they have an overlapping pain condition, if they also have myofascial pain. And I think that's where, you know, Adela didn't, she kind of sold herself short, but a lot of that counseling at the beginning of like, that she does of like where this fits and sort of their general pain care, you know, and their overall symptoms. And so that's where I think internal medicine and our partners in primary care can be really helpful to sort of take back the baton and kind of keep those conditions under check too after their surgery.
Yeah, and that speaks, I guess, to, and this could be a whole episode probably into itself, but I did want to touch on the idea of pain management specifically for endometriosis. So any general principles you'd like to share? You know, I was thinking about this. There's, you know, reading through the literature, there's a lot about central sensitization as part of this, but I don't see us reaching immediately for things like TCAs or gabapentinoid agents or anything like that. So if you could just sort of talk us through your general principles and maybe even just touch on if there's a role for opioid therapy, I think that would also be very helpful. And we'd be remiss if we didn't address it probably.
Yeah. So thinking about people who may not have responded as well to the hormonal treatments or are starting to experience pain a lot outside of menses, if they seem to either, you know, I think sometimes we use these questionnaires and they sort of tell us the obvious, but if we want to be more numeric about it, like the short central sensitization index, if they're scoring high on that, if we're seeing that they really have probably more overlapping pain conditions, I don't know what it is, but I think oftentimes the endometriosis surgeons and the gynecologists that do a lot of pain are thinking about all of these, because I don't know if our patients just tell us a lot, if it's the amount of time that we have, you know, Adela mentioned time, but I think sometimes we have this privilege of getting this bigger picture. And so I think some concrete things are, if we're seeing pain outside of their period, so sort of daily pain that's interfering with their functioning and their quality of life, if they have physical findings of central sensitization, so they fill out a pain map ahead, and right, you can see sort of the distributions of pain and other locations of pain. If they have sort of more than one or two overlapping pain syndromes, we will talk either if they have a good partner in internal medicine or family medicine about starting things like a neuromodulator, like amitriptyline, like gabapentin. And a lot of patient education there, because that's a sort of a new concept for a lot of endo patients, is thinking about that role. And, you know, excision surgery has received a lot of attention, but there's, like you said, a lot of nuance and a lot of layers and a lot of pearls that we've been talking about. And one of them is just that the chronicity of the pain can lead to, you know, more pain. And so we kind of need to address central sensitization when we see it. The other thing, though, is you mentioned medications, but on the other side of that, in addition to patient education, we work with pain psychologists and try to get a component of cognitive behavioral therapy and functional goal setting in. And we do that actually from the beginning. So we don't sort of wait for them to sort of have a central sensitization score that marks them as highly probable. We're kind of trying to do that right away so that they can use some more efficacious self-management strategies with their dysmenorrhea and their pelvic pain. So I think that's a great question. I think there's a role, and, you know, the heterogeneity of our patients makes it difficult to study. So do we have the best literature to support the use of gabapentin in these patients? You know, probably not. I won't find like a perfect article for you, you know, perfect research paper.
If you can find me a perfect pain management article in any field, domain, or condition, I will give you $1 million right
so
now.
So that's a huge challenge, right? They're not all the same. And then Adela and I were talking about, you know, the use of opioids. And she's mentioned this a bunch, which is that some patients just really can't do the hormonal therapy. They'll have significant side effects. They'll continue to be having menses, and they'll continue to be having flares. We don't really recommend, you know, chronic opioid therapy for chronic pelvic pain or for endometriosis. But Paul and Carolyn, just with your work, you can probably speak to the fact that there's a role possibly for judicious use in some patients for management of flares. But it's definitely not like our first, second or third line treatment.
All right. Well, I think we have done a lot of work here, a lot of great teaching, and certainly we're leaving some things on the table, but I think we've really given a great introduction to this topic and a lot of practical things that the audience can try to diagnose and work this up. So at this point, I think we're ready for take-home points. Adela, do you want to give one or two take-home points, and then Isabel, we'll take some from you as well?
Yes, I would say the biggest take-home points is you need to have endometriosis on your differential in order to even give that answer of suspected endometriosis to your patients. And so remembering that it exists, remembering that it is common, is very, very important, because that's a big step in recognizing it and getting patients the care that they need. And then the other take-home I think is very important is that negative imaging does not mean that endometriosis is not there. Not responding to hormones does not mean that endometriosis is not there. And so it is something that we don't understand very well, but those are things that we can say for sure.
I would say that I think essential to validate, you know, a patient's pain and their experience. I think that will help with a therapeutic relationship, since this is a chronic disease. I definitely advocate for learning the pelvic floor myofascial exam. I think if you're doing pap tests and pelvic exams, that is another incredible tool in your toolbox to really, really help your endo patients, your pain patients, and get them to physical therapy when they need to. And then I think just for our listeners, just thinking about yourself as needing a team around you. We talked about a lot of overlapping syndromes. We talked about having, you know, good imaging. We talked about having access to surgeons that can do these tough excision cases. So kind of being intentional that the GI that you work with doesn't just rule out cancer and IBD, but thinks about functional disorders, and the urologist you work with doesn't rule out stones, but thinks about painful bladder syndrome. So I think you guys have the hardest job to think about everything under the sun. So just remembering to have good teammates is what I would say.
Okay. And then anything that you all wanted to plug, work you're doing or organizations, anything, books you've written, I don't know, whatever, anything?
So there's some great articles I would recommend if you're interested in like pathophysiology and like future research. I think Stacey Mismer is pretty incredible, has a great New England Journal publication from 2020. If you want to go back and kind of dive a little bit deeper, that would be one I would recommend. I have a publication that I think is just really practical. It's called Persistent Pelvic Pain in Patients with Endo. So sort of when you send them to surgery and it just doesn't work, you know, and you're stuck again, right? You thought you were finished by getting them into surgery, and then they don't really necessarily meet those functional goals. I'd keep an eye out for some ultrasound and radiology guidelines, so that if you are working in kind of a high volume center, maybe collaborating with your radiologist to see if they can implement some of the easier ones that Adela talked about, like the sliding sign and the position of the ovaries. International Pelvic Pain Society is a great resource if you're seeing a lot of pain patients. It's a great organization with a lot of online resources for its members. And then I think the Beyond the Belt film is excellent by Shannon Kahn. I don't know if you've seen that, just to kind of get the patient perspective of endo is really powerful. Those are kind of the things I'd plug if you feel like learning more after okay. listening to us.
Yeah. And I'd like to second, Isabel mentioned some radiology guidelines that are going to be coming out. We, as she mentioned, work as a team. Dr. Wendelin Van Buren is Amazing. Our MRI specialized ultrasound endometriosis radiologist goddess. We love her. She is amazing. And I'm working on a systematic review with her. And then Dr. Angela Tong, who's a radiologist in New York. And we are looking at the state of the literature with ultrasound and MRI and trying to get a sense of what that means, not just kind of globally, but within different regions, because I think that that's something that's difficult to tease out just because the protocols can be so different. And so that's something we're working on getting published in the American Journal of Radiology, or AJR. And then she had mentioned that there's going to be some new guidelines coming out from SRU, which is more of an ultrasound-focused organization looking at guidelines for evaluating endometriosis as well.
All right. We can definitely link to whatever you mentioned there that's available currently, and we'll look out for the guidelines that are forthcoming. And I can't thank you both enough for all your time and just coordinating things so well. As you know, it's tricky having so many people on this, but I think you all did a great job just making your teaching points. And just so thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
There you go. Your time to shine, Dr. Jim. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we want your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps and makes us feel good about ourselves when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Special thanks to our writer and producer for this episode, Dr. Carolyn Chan, and to our whole team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.